Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for November 9th. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and joining me in cyberspace, but from Sapporo, is Jim Allen. How's it going, buddy? You freezing your butt off up there?
No, my butt is still here, still with me. So
little you had in the first place.
Well, that is as everyone's body image is a matter of whoever ugliness is or beauty is in the eye of the beholder or whatever, butt of the beholder or whatever.
Anyway. However that goes.
Anyway, so yes, no, it was actually quite comfortable today in the rain. It was very cold yesterday when it weren't raining. So anyway, that we had a lot of interesting stuff going on. Happy to be in Sapporo. Happy the Premier 12 started, and that was kind of fun.
All right, yeah. We're going to talk about the Premier 12 on this week's show. We've got an interview with former Yakult Swallows player Aaron Guile. We're going to talk about a lot more, so let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
All right, so I talked to Aaron Guile this week via the telephone. He lives in Phoenix, Arizona. He's a former Yakult Swallows outfielder, as I said. He played with them from 2007 to 2011. And it's so funny because when I talked to him before in 2013, I remember this specifically because I had a problem with this interview this week as well. I had to call him back and we had to redo the interview. I don't know if you remember this, but it was so bad. There was some feedback that was going on. It was so bad, I had to call him back and we had to redo the interview. And he was really, really understanding about it and very cooperative and very gracious again with the time. And we sat down and redid the interview. So this time I talked to him and we had the same thing. I had this buzz going on and I was thinking about calling him back to redo it. And I remember, wait a second, I did this 2 years ago. I was having deja vu. It was actually almost 3 years ago because that was February in 2013 that he was on the show before. And I'm like, oh no, I cannot do this to him again. So I had to play the role of Captain Buzzkill because you'll hear some of the buzzing still in there, and I had to stop rolling your eyes.
My eyes rolled when you told me that joke 2 days ago. I was thinking we should call you Buzzkill Lightyear or something.
Well, you just stop rolling your eyes right now, mister. If the joke's already on you, then you don't have to react. So anyway, I had to go through, and what I did was I just re-recorded my voice without the buzz because it was mostly when I was speaking and not when Aaron was speaking. But there is a little bit of buzz in there, so please forgive that. Now, he has been working as a consultant. He did some coaching when he retired from active play, and he did some coaching. But you'll hear in the interview that he basically needed to get away from the game a little bit just to complete that transition because it's a different lifestyle. And you'll hear him talk about that. And at the moment, he's, like I said, doing some consulting and doing some other things. He's also working on getting his green card because he is Canadian, but he's living in the United States. So he said he's working on getting his green card and he's enjoying raising his children. And he does pay attention to Japanese baseball, and he was paying a particular attention to the Yakult Swallows and the fact that the team was able to come back and win the Central League after being in last place for two consecutive years. So pretty interesting stuff, and I was really happy to sit down and talk to him. So except for the buzz, let's have a listen to Aaron Guile. All right, joining us from Phoenix, Arizona is former Yakult Swallows outfielder Aaron Guile. How's it going, buddy? Good to talk to you again.
Great, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks a lot for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So the last time we talked on this show was 2013, and at that time we were talking about the Swallows' approach to building a team. So how surprised were you to see that they won the Central League this past season?
Well, I think with the way baseball is in Japan, I think it's always possible because the Japanese baseball does not rely on very much on free agency. So I think if you have a good scouting class and a good group of young kids and some good arms come up, I think there's always the ability for a team in the middle to rise to the top. I know that we've always had good enthusiastic coaches when I was with the Swallows, and I know that we had some really good young players coming up. So when I was there with the Swallows, we were always just kind of on the edge, just you know, kind of almost making that jump to the next level. And with guys like Tony Barnett really stepping up and asserting his role, and Yamada, and I can still follow some of the guys here, and just seeing some of these young kids come up, there's a lot that I don't know. I shouldn't say surprised. I'm happy for them. But it's nice to see that, you know, since I left, that they may have added just that little one piece that got them to that position where they could take it over. I know they didn't, you know, especially with the playoffs are structured in Japan, you know, with the one game advantage, at least that's what it was when I was there. They do favor the top teams. So, for them to do it, I mean, it's quite an accomplishment, especially for the teams they have to beat.
So how tough is it for a team? I mean, this team went from double worst to first, two years in a row finishing in the cellar, and then it was able to come back and win the Central League.
That's extremely tough there for so many reasons. Just for the atmosphere and the culture that you have within a club. You know, I remember facing the Bay Stars when they were, you know, in the bottom of the league, bottom of our division. When you went into Yokohama, when you spoke to Yokohama players, and you knew the front office, there was just a culture there that they knew that it was going to be difficult for them to rise above. So, knowing the Swallows, I do think that the Swallows organization is a great group of people and a lot of good character. But when you finish last in Japan with six teams, you know, you can have a lot of people, you know, doubt the personnel that you have in that room. So for them to go to do that is pretty exceptional. You know, it's difficult for me, being from where I am, to see the individual players and see how they progress and see how they've matured, to find out how each one of them contributed to the improvement of the team. But I just know that I still know a handful of guys in that clubhouse and know how talented some of them are and what good character they are. So to see them go from that far down to winning the championship is pretty surprising. But I think that they obviously had some people that they were close, maybe some injuries. After speaking with Tony, I don't think Tony was completely surprised. But yeah, that's a long way to go, especially in that type of league.
Yes, certainly injuries played a role in the fact that they finished last those past 2 years, and then the fact that they were healthy this year certainly helped out. Now, what playing at Jingu Stadium, where it's a hitter-friendly park, what kind of impact does that have on a team that plays half of its games there?
Well, I think that it just depends on the type of team that you tailor yourself with and the players that you assemble in that lineup. And obviously you're pitching. You've got a guy like Tony Barnett, who throws a lot of cutters and some sinkers. If you're playing in a place like Jingu, then you really need to have the pitchers that keep the ball down in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
You also have to get some athletic kids in the outfield to chase the balls down. And then the guys that are real contact conscious, which is usually the issue in Japan. Most of the hitters that are in that lineup are contact first. So I think it depends on the type of team that you put around. And, I think from my experience, you know, Jingu is a very good place to hit. But after my first year, when they moved the corners out slightly, I think that it can play fair. But it doesn't compare to the bandbox of Tokyo, the Tokyo Dome. You know, I think the Giants' philosophy has always been to just outslug people. So I don't know. I think it's in contrast when you have Hiroshima, that's so big.
Mm-hmm.
Jingu is a little easier, but I think that if the manager and the coaches and have a philosophy on how to play with their stadium and take advantage of their stadium, and the front office has the model to draft players that will be successful in that stadium. I think that's the recipe for them.
All right. So how about for you now? Your transition to the sidelines, is that complete for you now?
Well, it's getting there. You know, I think people take for granted that you can segue your life from one thing to the next. When I realized that, you know, that I was going to stop playing, I was going to retire. I think I spoke with several players, including an old friend Mike Sweeney with the Royals, thought that, okay, baseball's over. You know, what's next? You can just enjoy it. But there's a really massive transition that does happen, especially after you've been playing so long. And most of it's psychological, and I have to be honest, it probably took 2 years before I dropped old habits, before I was able to resume, you know, the normal way of life and to get my life to a point in time where I was going to be successful in doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
In baseball, the schedule was always out for us. They always have the games lined out for us. They always order our uniforms. They always provide food. They always pay us. Everything is always done for the players. You know, when I was in Japan, we had an interpreter all the time on the road, and he would do our train tickets, and he would get our, you know, take care of the tickets for our family, and you know, the list is endless what
right.
those guys do for us.
Right.
So that transition has been difficult because you also get, you know, most guys have a little bit of a vent when you're playing baseball and things are getting a little stressful, whether it be at home, whether it be in anything that else is going on. You can go on the road for 3 or 4 days and just vent and get away. Well, when you get out of baseball, you really don't have anything like that. So you really got to find a way to balance your personality, your personal time and adjust your life. So most guys, when they retire after playing, you know, I was 19 years professionally. Most guys, when they retire, most of them will tell you, if they're being honest, that it's a lot more difficult to transition. Some do it fairly well, and from the outside, it would appear that they've seamlessly made that transition. Other guys really, really struggle, but, you know, whether it's financially and with their relationships with their families and things like that, it can be difficult. And if you're not aware of it or don't accept it or don't acknowledge that, I think a lot of guys have trouble. So mine went fairly well. But at the same time, there were things I had to deal with.
All right. So after hearing that response, and I know we chatted a little bit before we actually started the interview, but I'm just wondering, what would it take to get you back, possibly to Japan as a coach or a manager?
Well, I think that it wouldn't take very much. You know, Japan was 5 years of some of the most fun and challenging and enjoyable time of my baseball career. And you know, I talk with my wife and my kids. It was just, I mean, it was last week how we want to come back. So we have a lot of affection for Japan. We great, great memories.
Mm-hmm.
I love the style of baseball. I love the way that the culture embraces baseball. I love the way that the players approach the game with such respect. I love the way that the coaches kind of handle things. So if I did coach for a summer as an assistant hitting coach after I retired, and I think after playing in Japan and seeing how the players, how hard they worked, how respected they were, how the society stuff was, it was, when I coached in the U.S., it was a little difficult because you're dealing with big personalities and you're dealing with organizations, and it's quite different. So I think if there was an opportunity for me to coach or manage in Japan or even scout for a team in Japan, I think that it's something that I would think long hard about, because even though you have the logistics of being so far apart, we just have such great memories, and I mean, my wife loved it, my kids loved it. I know I've heard recently that Alex Ramirez, I believe he took the managing job with Yokohama.
That's right.
Yes, I think I would want to coach with someone before they became manager. Because I think that when you become a manager, you have a one chance to make a very good impression. You have one chance to lay groundwork and outline your plan, similar to a CEO with a job with a large company.
Right.
You are in control of everybody, so you have to make sure that you have the ability to delegate to certain guys, but maintain control of that ship.
Right.
And dictate the plan that you want going forward, because your personality and your work ethic and you're creating that culture. And I think that it's very important that you really, really know what you're getting into. So it sounds like Alex has done it before. Alex does have the type of personality where he likes to assume that role. And he was he was a coach before he retired playing, so I think he'll do really well. He's somebody that I could easily, if I was to be his hitting coach or bench coach, somebody that I could easily work with.
Yeah.
But if I think in
You mentioned Alex, but who are some other players maybe you played with or against who might be really good managerial candidates?
Well, I didn't get a chance to play with Matt Merton, but I think Matt Merton would also be a good one. He has a nice blend of fire and talent. Now, I don't know if Matt will be the type of player that would want to go back to Japan and manage, because we both know that to play and to manage and coach in Japan, you know, there's a certain type of personality. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's quite a few. There's a lot of guys. I think Adam Riggs wouldn't have been a bad one. I think that Fernando Seganal would have been a pretty good one.
Oh, yeah.
I think Jose Fernandez, you know, we're talking about guys where personalities were kind of fiery, or maybe they wouldn't have a desire to return to manage, but guys where you have kind of a laid-back personality, mm-hmm. but a good knowledge of the game, I think that's really key because of the cultural differences. Mm-hmm. I think that whoever does decide to manage or coach has to be able to have that patience, but also have the knowledge and be assertive in this to kind of put his plan out in place.
Hmm. All right.
I think a guy like Terry Collins, even though when Terry was over there, I think he had a difficult time because he is a pretty intense individual. Mm-hmm. And we've seen him have success this year with the Mets. But I think it's, for me, I don't think that is the type of personality that lends itself to being good long term in Japan. I think someone more like Alex Ramirez or a similar type player is probably better.
All right, interesting. So now we've seen a lot of impact or just a lot of emergence of NPB worldwide, but particularly in the West with Masahiro Tanaka and Yu Darvish going over to the States. So what do you think that impact of Japanese baseball is having on the West?
I think the West and Major League Baseball, they're starting to see just how much talent that there is there. I think Japan has the same type of issues that a lot of other countries like Canada and Australia have, where people just aren't familiar with the amount of talent and the skill level of the players that come from those particular countries. Mm-hmm. I think Venezuela and the Dominican Republic and Cuba and Puerto Rico, I think people are already aware of that because players have been flooding the Major League Baseball for a number of years. But you have a player like Ichiro come over and people think he's an anomaly. Well, then you get players like Yu Darvish and Tanaka to come over and people, it opens up people's eyes to just how certain players from Japan can come over and be dynamic in Major League Baseball. A lot of people and players in North America, I think they think that if you're going to get an offensive player, you can have a little slap hitter who's fast. If you're going to get a pitcher, you're going to get a control pitcher. And I think that they're kind of breaking the mold there. They're showing Major League Baseball that there is some really good talent there. You also have a player like Kawasaki, who, you know, Japanese have a reputation for being very disciplined, very quiet, just go about their business. You know, they almost have their poker face on all the time.
Uh-huh.
You have a kid like Kawasaki who goes to Toronto and completely flips the script on that and is probably one of the most entertaining players that whole team has.
Yeah, that's for sure. His little interviews are going viral. All right, what was that?
You have a player that they call up strictly so that he can lighten the mood and create a good atmosphere. When you call a player that's 95% of his role, then that says a lot about the guy's character.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. All right, last one here. The inaugural Premier 12 is starting up this weekend. What are you personally expecting to see from the Canadian team?
Well, I've seen a lot of the guys that are going over there. It's definitely not our best representation as far as what it is. It's a really good collection of players that are available.
Mm-hmm.
But you won't see the some players that are going to go over that may have been eligible that would look at the WBC for sure. So even though I'm taking a quick look at the roster,
mm-hmm.
I think it's a really good thing. I think the timing is way better than the WBC. I think it's way better than WBC. But I think that the talent because everyone thinks because the AWC was initiated by teams over here by Major League Baseball that it's going to be the best. So the Major League Baseball takes it a lot more seriously.
Right.
But hopefully that tournament there is something that captures everybody's attention and pride, makes them maybe put their top teams. I haven't had a chance to see the U.S. team, so I don't know if it's a high level collection.
Right.
But I know Canada's is kind of medium to upper level. And I'm just curious to see what, you know, Korea and Japan do.
All right. Well, we appreciate very much you taking the time this morning to get up and talk with us on JBW, and good luck.
Thanks a lot, John. Nice to hear from you.
And stay in touch, and we hope to see you soon.
Will do. Take care.
All right. You too. Thank you.
All right. Thank you again, Aaron. Really appreciated you taking the time to wake up early in the morning and chat with us.
Yeah. Well, that was good. It was good hearing you. It's been a long time, so always look forward to this. Now, first of all, John, I have to say that, you know, I loved, as much as I loved hearing Aaron, I think you can no longer get on me about my long-winded introductions.
Yes, I can, because you've got a million of them. I got like one or two.
Okay, fair enough. That's the rules. We're just establishing the rules today. I can blame John for everything, and he can blame me for my introductions.
See, you can never win any of these arguments because you bring your mouth.
Hashtag high heat.
Well, again, like the size of one's butt, winning an argument is in the eye of the beholder. Okay. if you think you never lose, then the other guy never wins.
Okay.
Because it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. Anyway.
So what stuck out for you in this chat?
Jeez.
Besides the buzzing.
Well, yeah. Well, you get over that. But I really enjoyed it. And I think a couple of things were very interesting. I love Aaron because he's really, really a good observer mm-hmm. of what goes on. And he uses words that we don't expect, you know, players to use all the time, anomaly and so on and so forth. But again, you know, because he's not in Tokyo watching the Swallows, talking to people on a daily basis, you know, he kind of reserted to you know, I felt he was really struggling for answers to explain the Swallows. Mm-hmm. And I understand that completely. I mean, we do that on a weekly basis. he's got to come out and throw out some heavyweight cliches, you know, to do what we do, you know, to make it sound like we know what we're talking about. Anyway, so as far as a couple of points, one is Jingu playing fair. I think he's right about that. I think it's just to give the listeners a good a number of years sense of context here. Jingu is still a better hitter's park in every way than Tokyo Dome, mm-hmm. although they're very close in home runs. Jingu is a better home run park, but they're close.
Right.
But Tokyo Dome is not a good hitter's park in the sense that it's not good for scoring runs because it helps home runs to some degree, it hurts everything else. It's hard to hit for average there. It's easy to strike out there and so on. It's hard to get on base there. Mm-hmm. So whereas Jingu, it's really good for people to hit for average. And that having said that, Jingu was Tokyo Dome was a better home run park this year, a better run scoring park. But these things change. Now, speaking of parks, I'm not really sold on the idea. You know, when people say you got to tailor your team to fit your park, because mm-hmm. it sounds like, and the reason I'm not sold on it is because we have this impression. So you find a player, you know, who's lacking some part of his game and make him a good player because of the park he plays in. But I'm not really a believer in that because, you know, he's got to play in other parks.
And that was going to be my point about that exactly, is that you can tailor your team to play well or better than your opponents at your park, but you can't tailor it to play specifically in that park because you have to play the other half of your games in
Absolutely.
Other parks.
Yeah. You know, I think what we're talking about, and I think the better way to look at this is to think of it as choosing the kind of balance you want in a player. So, for example, if you've got a guy at one position, let's just say outfield, since he mentioned the outfield, do you want a guy who's a little better defensively or someone with slightly more offense? You know, we're talking about marginal issues. Mm-hmm. A guy who's going to hit an extra two or three home runs as opposed to a guy who's going to throw out a few more guys on the bases. I think that those are the decisions you have to make. Anytime you start looking for a guy and say, oh, well, he's Jingu, we got to have guys who hit home runs, and you overlook the rest of their games, you're just asking for trouble. Now, the other thing is, I thought, what I really loved, and I don't want to get on Aaron for that, because, again, he's trying to talk about things that he's not really here with, but I love the idea of the culture, comparing the Bay Stars and the Swallows. And I think the Bay Stars culture has changed. I think it started changing about 6 or 7 years ago when Takao Obana was their manager. Mm-hmm. But it's still got a ways to go, and it's still sort of going through transition. They're sort of like skipping gears. You know, they're trying to sort of grinding gears on the automatic transmission, trying to shift from one philosophy to another. And it's not been a smooth transition. So anyway, so I like that point. And the last thing I think was quite good was about his adjustment to life after baseball. I thought that was artistic. I think his analysis, and this shows what Aaron Giles really capable of as a communicator and as a person who can think about things and present them in a very careful, easy to understand package. And I want to thank him for that, because that was really good stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
a great question from you too. I have to admit that was a brilliant question.
Well, thank you. You went through so many things there. Again, he talked about a team that he hasn't really been looking at, and as soon as he said that, I thought, well, you know, Coco Ballantyne didn't play a lot this year. He was, because of the injuries that he suffered. So he came at a point where, you know, they basically had their team established. But I had complained about their outfield defense. He mentioned that you really need guys who can, he said, kids who can go and get the ball. And I thought, that's odd, because I was complaining about their outfield defense, particularly with Yuhei starting the season in center and saying that wasn't really going to be a solution. And quickly, the team realized that and moved him to right field. I don't know about quickly, and I don't know about realizing that, but I think
they did.
Yeah, they figured that he'd be more effective and would be more of a contributor with his arm if he were in right field. And they played through those I would call them not handicaps, but those issues that they had with the outfield, and they won despite it. And they were fine defensively, I thought. I didn't think they really needed, particularly when they do play Ballantyne out in left field. I don't think he's one of those kids who's really going to go get him, but he doesn't hurt them in left field. He doesn't, you know, he's not doing a lot of damage out there. So, and then the fact that Aaron called Tokyo Dome a bandbox, and I thought, okay, well, this the context of that is that he played when the balls were really lively, and he hasn't been playing when they haven't been lively, and that's really changed the dynamic at Tokyo Dome. It's not that lively stadium that produces a bunch of pop fly home runs anymore.
That's correct. In fact, Aaron and I had this discussion with a number of players when they talked about when I talked about Tokyo Dome, and I said, this place used to be really hard to, he says, no, it's because the ball carries. I say, hold on. When they opened Tokyo Dome, nobody hit the big scoreboards, you know, where they used to give out 1 million yen in prizes. Mm-hmm. But during the lively ball era, it was like 5 or 6 a month. I mean, it used to be 2 a year.
Mm.
And nobody hit them. I mean, just nobody hit them. And then they changed the balls, and suddenly it became a bandbox. Well, it was always a bandbox because of the short left and right field fence. Walls, but in that respect, but in terms of the ball carrying, that was as much to do with the ball than anything.
Yeah. So, but I guess the biggest thing that stood out for me in this chat was when I asked him about managerial candidates, and the list of names that he brought up were, you know, first of all, he said he'd be back in a flash, which, you know, having spoken to him before the interview, it didn't seem like he'd be interested in that kind of job or that kind of scenario at all, returning to Japan to coach or manage. But, you know, Matt Merton high on his list was a big shocker for me, although he did talk about the personalities, and he did describe Alex Ramirez and who else was it? Adam Riggs or someone else as very easygoing guys. I think it was Jose Fernandez, he said.
Yes. Not as easy guy as kind of intense guys who could be. Yeah. They played the game with intensity, who could sort of tone it down a little bit.
Right, if they were not in the game, right. And so basically they could have the fire and the passion of maybe Hiroki Kokubo, who's now the manager of the Samurai Japan team, but be able to harness that and focus it on the players and the tactics and the umpires rather than, you know, yelling at things that he can't control. So I found that really interesting. And Adam Riggs, I thought, was a really interesting, because I didn't really get to talk to Adam that much. I think I talked to him the year he had, you know, almost 40 home runs. It was you're laughing. I know there's a story behind that, but
there is a story behind
2006,
that.
I think it was, he had 39 homers. And I remember talking to him. It was a short conversation. I saw him out at the field a number of times that season, but I didn't really have in-depth, and we weren't doing this show, so you know, it's just mostly shooting the breeze. I didn't get the idea that he'd be a coach or manager, so to have that name come up, that was interesting for me.
Well, that was a blast from the past. I don't want to go into the details. We'll save that story for another. We ought to get Adam on the show and talk about that one. But I wasn't surprised by Aaron talking about wanting to coach here, because actually he told me back in the day, that's how long it's been, that he would love to coach for Ramichan if Ramichan became a manager.
Huh.
So that one was interesting. I was surprised by the Merton. I was surprised, actually, that he didn't mention Monaka because they were teammates. But I guess...
Monaka's the kind of guy you kind of see him working hard and hustling, but you don't remember him. He doesn't come to mind, I don't think, right away.
What struck me as being very articulate when Tetsuto Yamada began breaking out last year, and I don't mean with acne, although he's young enough for that. He's still a preteen, I think. And I had a chat with Monaco, who is the Swole's batting coach, and he said, you know, it's about his bat speed and his making contact, and that's everything, and that's all there is. And he had managed him, of course, in the minors, so he was well aware of that. But he was, you know, he was to the point, and he didn't waste words, and he didn't leave anything out. So I love that.
Yeah, I, you know, met with Matt. I just, you know, I with Matt Merton, I would think that he has more to offer as a player. So I don't really see him as a guy who's ready to transition into that phase. But we've seen the relationship that he has developed with Kansai-based media outlets and with umpires, and I don't know that they're irreconcilable.
There's a few catchers. I've talked to all the catchers involved, and for them it's nothing personal. For him it's nothing personal. So
don't crash into me, bro.
Well, you know, the thing about Matt, and you mentioned the relationship with the Kansai media. He actually has a good relationship with the media. It's the editors and the team that's the issue. And I think actually the Daily Sports is probably, they're probably really upset that Merton's leaving.
You got no more, because fall guy.
Well, yeah, exactly. They're going to have to find somebody new. They, you know, he was all polished, ready to be their excuse for everything that was wrong with the Tigers. And now that he's gone, they're going to, geez, what are we going to do now? They must be really, I'll bet that somebody's losing some sleep trying to figure out how they can blame the next failure, because it can't be on Kanemoto.
Well, whoever some foreign coach who comes, not coach, I'm thinking of O'Malley, foreign player who comes in there who, you know, strikes out three times in a row, he'll be first up on the podium.
Could be different. But anyway, that was, O'Malley kind of struck me as an interesting. Jose Fernandez, somehow I don't see him being a manager type. I saw him as being a scout, but I'm surprised, and it's a surprise to me that nobody has signed him as a scout. But I think there's other. He's got things he wants to do that don't involve baseball. Maybe
that's possible. That's possible. But yeah, the things that we talked about, and we talked about all kinds of sports, not just baseball. We talked about basketball and football. He's a big-time sports fan, and it was always about strategy. I would always ask him, okay, well, you got this situation. Who are you going to use for this and that and the other?
Yeah.
And he's got the tactics down, so I think he'd be good. All right, well, it was really fun. Thank you very much, Aaron. I appreciate it. He had to wake up kind of early in Arizona, and I had to stay up kind of late on this end, but we got it done. And again, apologies for the buzzing, but I don't think it was that bad after you got into it.
Well, now that you've been through it, it wasn't that bad. Yeah. It hurt a little bit at first, but the pain is over.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about the game that you were at tonight on Sunday evening, and I guess it's early Monday morning now here, but
it's not only the podcast for Monday, it's the podcast being recorded on Monday.
Yep, it happens. So 5-0 shutout over the Samurai Japan team wins over South Korea at Sapporo Dome. Shohei Ohtani hits 100 on the gun, that's 161 in kilometers per hour here. And he was dominant, struck out 10 over 6 innings, allowed 2 hits, 2 walks. Really, really nice start for him considering.
Yeah.
And I mean considering because he didn't have a good outing the other day in a little warm-up.
And he got hammered in his last start before that in the postseason.
He got battered, yeah. And it was at Sapporo Dome in front of the home fans. So
sure.
And yeah, a really nice game for Samurai Japan to start out this Premier 12 tournament with, and beating the arch rival. And they knocked out their ace early on. I think the Koreans were a little quick on the gun there to yank their guy, but
I don't know.
I don't know either. It just seemed like a panic move to me.
I think what I saw was three balls that were smoked, you know, and they were lucky they had a ball back. You know, they're lucky there was something left of those balls. You know, they had, after Yamada made another kind of easy out, it's like he's looking for pitches that he's not getting and he's missing them. Or he's trying to make adjustments and he hasn't been getting great results. He's been, you know, he swings well. But anyway, so he made a first out, and then the next three balls were absolutely crushed, and they were lucky to get one out of that. And they said, okay, that's enough. And I was about to ask Kokobo about that, what adjustments. And they said, we were just basically got used to seeing this slider. It's really an up and down slider that is so hard to hit. It drops out of the zone, and we had trouble with it at first, but that, you know, we were prepared to lay off it, and as soon as we had a look at it, we were able to lay off it.
Yeah, they took some really close pitches that were down around the knees that were, you know, he wanted for strikes, the Korean team wanted for strikes, but they really weren't strikes. They were really close. They were tough to take.
And Kim In-sik, who I love, who was the manager of South Korea at the 2006 and 2009 World Baseball Classics when they did very well,
mm-hmm.
He said that one of the problems was the catcher. Basically, I think he was having trouble catching that slider,
mm-hmm.
And so he wasn't calling it as much as his pitcher wanted him to, and so he was catching pitches that were easier. He was calling for pitches that were easier to catch. And it was easier to catch some bats.
Yeah, I was going to say, easier for everybody to catch, including your outfielders off the wall.
Indeed.
All right, so Japan scores a couple runs in the second inning, and it was so Japan the way they scored these runs. Sho Nakata swings at a pitch that he had no business swinging at, and it bounces past the catcher for a wild pitch strikeout, and he reaches first, and then eventually he comes around to score on a ball that Ryosuke Hirata hits up the third base line that basically confused Her Kyung Min.
It's good enough.
Good enough, okay. And he wasn't able to attack the ball, move forward and go after it, and he didn't know whether to lay back on it, and then it ticked off his glove, and it hit the bag. I don't remember in which order, if it hit the bag and hit his glove. I would assume it hit his glove first. And rolls into foul territory, and Nakata ends up scoring, and that's how they got the first run, and then they ended up getting some more guys on base. Sakamoto hits a fly ball that goes in the right field and is deep enough to allow Matsuda to come home from third, so it's 2-0 Japan. So they end up adding some more runs. They got a home run from Sakamoto later, who, you know, he looked like he had a really good swing. Of course, we know that he's notoriously a good inside pitch hitter or inside ball hitter, and they left the one over the plate inside. Yeah. And he mashed it.
They were trying to go like way inside, like 5 or 6 inches inside, and left it right on the edge of the plate. Bam-o.
Yeah. Those don't come back when he's playing.
Yeah, I mean, it was outside. Okay, let's go inside. And already, you know, that was a setup pitch, and they didn't get to make the payoff pitch.
So how good was Ohtani tonight? Because, I mean, he was dotting with that fastball at times, but I think it was the fork that had everybody so off balance for the Korean team.
Yeah, that was absolutely it, because he could throw it for strikes when he wanted to, and he could throw it out of the zone when he wanted to. And Motohiro Shima, the Japan captain and the Rakuten catcher, said, it was unbelievable. His forkball was better than I imagined it could be. He also threw in a curve. He also threw in this curve. Was like, you've seen the fork. Maybe this will be fun. I think that was his last his last strikeout. It was like going, oh, man, don't do that to us. I almost saw a white flag flying from the Korean. I love it when he throws his curveball. So it was good.
So you think that was a good display for him in terms on the international level for his eventual move to the States, to MLB?
Well, it's hard to say, because one of this – The Premier 12, in contrast with, you know, the WBC and such, is that they use a Japan ball. So whereas Japan uses the ball that's most unlike the Major League ball when they go and play in the WBC, they're using the tournament ball. You know, and I'm waiting to hear what Victor Mesa has to say about that, because
the manager of the Cuban team.
Yes, because. You know, they asked, because people found out that Mizuno makes Cuban League baseballs. And the reporters here thought, well, they must have the same problem adjusting to the Major League balls that Japan players have. And he said, but the Mizuno ball they sell to Cuba is very much like the Major League ball. And he said, why? They're baseballs. We don't play with, you know, we don't play baseball with basketballs. Right. You might say something like, this is not a baseball. This is more like a basketball.
So a good start for them. Now, what do you think about, and Aaron, he touched on it briefly, but I wanted to mention this, that the timing of this tournament was really good, he said, because it's late in the year. It's not, you know how in the WBC, all the teams seem to be complaining about how earlier in the year it is, and that the Asian teams have such a big advantage because they start getting ready early. They have the fall camp. They have their February 1st spring, quote-unquote, spring training. So here's something in November at the end of the season for a lot of places.
Well, it's good for the minor leaguers, because their season ends basically, you know, on September 1st, unless they're in the postseason. So it's good for them. And, of course, the major leagues don't want to take part anyway. They don't want to send players. And they don't – I've got a one-minute rant here, which is the major leagues – don't really give a hoot whether the United States wins at all. They only care if their low minor leaguers get international experience or not. That's why you don't see Matt Merton or somebody who's very familiar with Japanese pitching playing for the United States, because he doesn't help. Him helping the United States win a medal or come in first doesn't help major league owners at all. Therefore, they don't care.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the same thing we hear about the WBC, is that, well, it's too early in the year, and they don't want to have their play. Even though they initiated, you've talked about the famous story about, I thought it was Buck Martinez, who just wanted to get his players in there to get some work in a WBC.
Well, that was the last one. That was Davey Johnson in 2009. That was a Bob Whiting, I think, talked about that. Basically, when people asked, and I don't remember, I was at the press conference after Japan beat the United States in the semifinal, and somebody asked him why he changed from a guy who was working to who was effective to somebody who wasn't. He said, well, the season's coming up, and I wanted him to get some work in.
Right, and so that was the attitude in that tournament, and I guess they have less of a will to win in this tournament, so
they're not
expecting that much. Now, okay, on Thursday, Japan had a warm-up game with Puerto Rico, which it won 8-3. Kenta Maeda faced 10 batters over 3 innings. He struck out 8 of them. He was awesome. Ohtani was shaky in his game. He allowed 2 runs on 3 hits in his inning. But Yuki Matsui probably should have allowed a run, but he didn't because Hirata, the aforementioned Hirata, threw out a batter or a runner at the plate, and then he got out of the jam that he was in. So they were not impressive, and yet they were impressive.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about Ohtani is somebody asked, and this I thought was a very good question, somebody asked Kokubo during the post-game press conference tonight if he had any second thoughts about Ohtani after seeing him get beaten, you know, beaten to a pulp in the climax series and then looking poor against Puerto Rico. And he said, Nope, I'm good.
He's going to be our guy. He's going to be our guy. We're going to ride him.
Excellent. Yeah, good for that. And the other thing I think was interesting is that the play at the plate that saved Japan was a play that was only allowed because Japanese umpires were running the game.
Where
Nakamura, the catcher, blocked the plate without the ball. That is prohibited in the Premier 12.
Right. Yeah.
So if they'd been playing by, although there was arguably, I mean, the Korean catcher, he didn't get down and block the plate. He left it open for a slide. So I guess that was okay. But in the majors, they might have looked at that one again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, so that's a rule, and Kokubo said, "Well, it's going to be hard for us to get used to playing by the rules."
By these rules, I like.
Well,
the way
of course, what they say in Japan is by this new rule,
right?
As opposed to the old rule we ignore.
Hashtag high.
It's the same rule, dude.
Yeah, I was going to say. I know what you're saying. It's the same rule. It's just enforced here. All right, and then on Friday, game two, Motohiro Shima. Gets a walk-off hit after Shobo Akiyama tied the score with an RBI single, and they won a walk-off 3-2 over Puerto Rico. And the bullpen did a really good job in this game. I was really impressed with the fact. I mean, they weren't clean, but they kept the scoreboard clean, and that's what's important. And that stuff goes unnoticed a lot when you have a comeback that's, you know, you have a pitcher who gives up a couple early runs, and then the score stays the way it is, and the offense has an opportunity to come back, and it does. You kind of overlook the guys who did the work in the middle, but the bullpen was really good. And you look at Shima; he's not a great hitter. I mean, he's had some good moments. He's had a good season, but he's batting ninth. You know, he batted ninth in the opener, the Premier 12 opener tonight, and he's batting there for a reason. He came through. Yeah, I was kind of impressed with that at bat.
I think we should call the game 2-3-2 win us the Swallows, you know, the Yakult version of that series, and we call the 8-3-1 the SoftBank version. Because the 3-2 one was like a lot of Swallows wins. I don't mean they won a lot of close games, because that really wasn't the case, but they had a lot of games where the bullpen just somehow managed to keep the game close. You know, they might have had an early lead, but it stayed that way. So very interesting. And I guess the other thing I would mention was, actually this struck me tonight, was, I don't know, another rant, but why when Shogo, it's a 2-0 game and they've got the leadoff, Shima's on with a single or a walk, I don't remember which, and the leadoff hitter, Shogo Akiyama, who's just been on an on-base machine, is bunting him over. First pitch ball, second pitch ball. Why is he still bunting? You've got the best hitter you could have on your team bunting with a 2-0 pitch. He eventually got down a sacrifice on a 3-1 pitch so that they could run themselves out of the inning. God!
Because they
bang
had
your hit.
Well, that's
bang
what they do. That's what they do.
But stop doing it. Swallows don't have. Well, you don't have to do it.
You're asking them to change their DNA. They can change their thinking. They can change the mindset, but I don't think they're going to change the DNA. That's just what's going to happen.
Okay. I need to get over this then.
You need to get over it. Yep. Okay. All right. Let's make a four-seam transition and talk about a couple pitchers and a hitter who's going to be leaving now. Tony Barnett of the Yakult Swallows is going to be. Well, he was. I believe it's already.
He was posted. It was filed yesterday.
He is posted by the Swallows And he's going to try to go back to the major leagues. I say back to the major leagues. He's never pitched on a major league mound, but he wants to go back to the States and play and try to get to the major leagues. And I was talking to Aaron about this too before we started the interview. And I said, look, the iron is, it couldn't be hotter for him right now. He's never been a better pitcher. He's never had better results. He really understands the art of pitching now. I think he's a better pitcher than he was when he had maybe better velocity, if he had better velocity when he was young.
And no, he is a better pitcher.
And this is his best chance, so I don't see a problem with it.
I've heard, you know, I've heard it and I've said it over and over again. These guys come to Japan, and if they have an extra gear, Japan helps them find it. Whether that's mentally, and I think part of that, and people have given me a lot of different reasons for him. One is respect for the game. One is learning to adapt to radically different challenges. Mm-hmm. You know, it pulls something out of you. And well, that's my explanation. Other people have given me ones and they say, no, that's not it. But, you know, so many guys have come over here who've been very, very marginal players. And so they were available to Japanese teams. But I'm thinking of Scott Acheson, Colby Lewis, Ryan Vogelsong. These guys, you know, and Colby Lewis had that conversation with Miles Michaelis, which when they were with the Rangers, he says, go to Japan, it'll make you a better pitcher.
Right.
And I believe that is certainly, I don't know if coming to Japan will make you a better pitcher, but it offers you an opportunity to become a better pitcher.
Yep,
and
yep.
So I think Tony's is a better pitcher, and I think his, you know, his head is absolutely in the right place, and this may be his best chance, and, you know, we wish him well. And he's, and the whole thing behind this was that, you know, he could have just said, I'm going to leave, make me a free agent, mm-hmm. because it's hard to keep him if, you know, he doesn't want to stay, and they wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, if you guys want to post me, you can get some money out of this.
Right.
And it was out of respect for the Swallows and the opportunity they gave him. So, you know, credit to him for that.
Right. And he could end up being, you know, coming back to the Swallows. In fact, I did some homework. I talked to a general manager who mm-hmm. has often been kind enough to give me some information about how teams feel about players in Japan. And so he talked to me about Tony. He said, quote, he could be a seventh or eighth inning type guy. He's got very good velocity and good makeup and good understanding of MLB, the game in MLB as well. So he also said, this general manager, because we also have Lee Daiho, who's going to be trying mm-hmm. at 33 to go back. And Tony actually turns 32 on November 9th, so he is going to be 32. So we've got these 30-somethings who want to go back. And then we do have Tsuyoshi Wada, who did sign again to play with the to return to the SoftBank Hawks, the lefty pitcher who at first went to Baltimore and then pitched with the Chicago Cubs.
Mm-hmm.
So this GM said that or this front office guy, I wouldn't say that he's a GM, but he's a front office guy. These MLB clubs see Maeda and Lee and Barnett as guys who might become available, but they're not sure. So now they're sure. Maeda, we still don't know. I'm thinking he's going to be trying out for the States too, and then he's going to demand the post if he does really well in this tournament. But all the things he said, he's just left it up in the air. So who knows what he really wants? I mean, we know that he wants to go, but
right.
Who knows what demands he can make and what promises he has made and what backroom deals we don't know about.
Right. Now, yes, and again, no secret, and I would be very surprised if the Carp are going to keep him. And I'm going to be very surprised if Hiroki Kuroda doesn't retire.
This offseason?
And I think that will complicate matters. I think right now he's probably mulling that over, whether he's done. So I think if he retires, I think there's no chance. If Kuroda says he's going to stay another year, then that might open the door for Maeda to go.
Interesting. All right. So Wada coming back to the SoftBank Hawks, and this is a vastly improved team from when he left, particularly on the mound. They have so many pitchers, and he has had Tommy John surgery. he has been so-so since that. He didn't really get much of a chance with Baltimore. He was injured right away. He didn't get that much of a chance with Chicago. They gave him a few opportunities, but not many. But I think he's a useful pitcher still, and I certainly know that he knows how to get out Japanese guys. But his problem now is going to be joining that legion of pitchers, the legion of pitchers in Fukuoka, and I don't know he's going to get that many opportunities there either.
Yeah, that was interesting. Now, I think he has more major league value. The way he pitched with the Cubs, you know, he had actually a very good record with the Cubs for the opportunities he had. He pitched very well. I would say he pitched very well in 75% of his starts.
Yeah, I didn't think he was bad at all.
He got hammered a couple of times, and one of those times he was pitching when he was hurt, and he got hurt in the game. So I think he was quite good, and he, you know, pitching in a very high run environment, you know, having a 3.7 something ERA is pretty good. And I think he has a lot of major league value because of his command and his ability to – the fact that it's very hard to see his – pick up his release point and differentiate between his slider and his slider, changeup, and fastball. Yeah. They're all coming at you from the same angle. They're very hard, and it's, you know, he makes this – you know, nobody likes his velocity because his fastball is about 88 miles an hour. And nobody likes it, but when you're looking for a slider and changeup, you know, down at the knees, and he throws that fastball in on your hands and up and in, the thing looks like it's 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard people complain about the velocity and say that it's not enough, but, you know, then you hear batters talk about how hard it is to pick up the ball and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he's coming back, but I don't see... I guess he's going to have to really work his way back into that rotation, which I'm sure he's fully capable of doing. But it's not going to be given to him.
Actually, I don't see him being as effective in Japan as I see him being effective in America.
Interesting. Yeah.
Because of that thing, you know, he can exploit this desire to pounce on everything. And here in Japan, they're going to say, "Oh, I don't have to swing at that. Oh, okay, I'm not."
Okay.
I mean, you can't expand the strike zone against everybody.
Okay. All right. It's going to be interesting to see how many innings he can get with them and also to see what happens with Tony Barnett, although I did hear someone else say that probably no teams are going to be willing to pay anything. Mm. So that it's probably not going to pan out that way.
I think so, too. I think that is what's going to happen. I think he's going to spend another year with Yakult out of sort of, you know, I gave him the opportunity, and the next year I'll be a free agent and go back.
Yep. Okay. All right. Let's go to fielding questions. This one comes from Dave, and this is a holdover from last week. And he says, I noticed a while back that the Giants have never hired a manager who ever wore the uniform of another NPB team. To clarify, a couple like Sadaharu Oh did after they were Giants managers, but never before they were a Giants manager. This has been 80 years now. I don't think it's a coincidence. So his question, and he talks about Yoshinobu Takahashi being hired as the latest manager, Giants manager, and being given the job. And he says, I'm curious what you guys think of this, this aspect of the Giants not hiring outside the Giants realm or scope.
I thought that was very astute, Dave. It hadn't really, you know, obviously this is something I think we know intuitively or we sense, but I was really impressed that you picked up on it because I didn't give it much thought at all. Maybe I'm so used to it. I think that's accurate. I think that I don't know about Matsui not wanting to go with another NPB team. I don't think Matsui wants anything to do with NPB, to be honest. His life is in New York. He loves that aspect of baseball. I think you'll see Matsui coach in the majors before you see him coaching in Japan. As far as Takahashi going, I didn't really see him playing for another team because he's big on identity. And what I mean when I say that is the time when Tatsunori Hara took this guy who was. He was a disciple of Kazuhiro Kiyohara, you know, the guts, and we're going to make an effort. We're going to make a showy, cartoonish, manga-like effort to play fierce, fierce, competitive, honorable baseball that had nothing to do with winning and losing games. It was all about making a showy effort.
Right, the showmanship.
Doing things in a big way. And he was part of that Kiyohara clique. And there was another group of players who were sort of the Matsui clique, which was, we do everything we can to win the game. Players like Toshihisa Nishi and a number of others. So Uehara was in that group. So Takahashi was this kind of a showy guy, and he needed his role to sort of cement that. This is all, I apologize for the pseudo-psychological babble here, but he was cemented. His role, his identity was as an RBI guy. And so when he was underperforming, and which was typical, his career basically went downhill from the time he was 24 years old, Tatsunori Hara said, "Hey, RBI guy, I want you to be my leadoff hitter."
I remember that.
And Takahashi was offended. But what he did was he had a 440 on base percentage that year, and he led off the Giants all the way to the pennant. That would have been 2008. And it was just amazing what he did, him and Yoshitomo Tani. These two guys who were sort of big hitters, and Tani was this number two hitter, and Yoshinobu Takahashi was the leadoff hitter, and they were just killers. They set up that amazing season offense the Giants had. So it's interesting that, you know. So when I saw that, and I heard about how offended he was, you know, and I'm going to show him kind of attitude. I think his identity, another part of his identity was that he was Yoshinobu Takahashi of the Giants. Mm-hmm. I think he would have stayed with it. I think the day the Giants said, "It's time for you to retire," or it's time that we don't want you, he'd said, "Okay, will you throw me a retirement ceremony?" Unfortunately, that didn't work out.
Right, yeah. So, well, what I did is I went to one of the beat writers who has been covering the Giants for years, and I talked to him, and it was amazing because I sat down and I pointed this fact out. I said, "Look, no one has ever managed a team who hasn't been involved with the team as a player or from the start, you know, hasn't been."
Nobody who ever left the Giants came back as a manager.
Right. And this guy looked up and he said, "You know, you're right." And so, again, Dave, you know, props to you for pointing that out, because I don't think anybody's ever thought about it, including some of these people, including the guys who cover the team on a daily basis and have covered it for years. So he sat there and he paused and he said, "I don't think it's a well-known or publicized fact, but it's probably part of the fabric of the Giants." You know, I don't think it's something that they do intentionally, or they started out to do intentionally, but it has become tradition, is what he used. He used the word tradition. And so that's been in place so long, I don't think they're going to break it. There's really no reason to.
Well, the interesting thing here is the guy who they made their third team manager, who was their head coach, did that. So if Mr. Kawhi proves adept at being a minor league manager and Takahashi doesn't pan out, we might Masahiro Kawhi might be the guy to test that theory.
Because he went and worked as a coach for the Dragons, right?
Correct. They in 2003, when the Giants kind of wanted Tatsunori Hara to stay, despite what the chairman Tsuneo Watanabe was saying when he was drunk to reporters, was that before Hara quit, Kawhi was going to retire and become a coach under Hara in 2004. But when Hara quit, his entire staff left. And the Giants said, "Well, we'd still like you to retire and be a coach." And he said, "Are you out of your minds? I don't want to have anything to do with you bozos."
Right.
And he played another 2 years with the Chunichi Dragons and then became a Dragons coach and then came back to the Giants as a coach.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I did say to this reporter, though, is I think the reason, or one of the reasons that they put a fairly young guy in Takahashi in charge is because they don't want to deal with this managerial situation anytime soon. And you said Takahashi failing or succeeding. I don't really think I think he's going to be the sorry for the comparison, because I don't think they're anything alike, but I just think he's going to be the figurehead, and that other guys are going to be running the team, similar to something that is going to develop, I think, with the Hanshin Tigers, and they've got Kakifu there to help Kanemoto out. Now, you're making faces, but I am.
Kakifu helping anybody out. I'm wondering how many fingers they're missing.
Well, okay. Just stop it. And then we know that Kiyoshi Nakahata DNA was a figurehead, some more so than he was a manager, and he was a figure out in front. He was a face of the
yeah, he was poster boy, I guess.
Right. And I think that's where Takahashi is going to start out, and he's going to work his way into the managerial thing. So I don't think we're going to have to worry about a pass or fail for him in particular, unless the whole organization below him just falls apart, because I don't think he's going to be making all the serious decisions.
Well, he hasn't been a full-time coach. He's been like a part-time coach. Yeah. And the comparison, I think I made this last week, the comparisons are striking. And I thought when Tatsunori Hara was made the Giants manager, I never foresaw any of the broad-reaching changes. He revitalized the Giants. He was at the heart of revitalizing the Giants. And I never saw any of that coming, because Hara as a player was a clone for Takahashi. Those two were so much alike. Hara was a better player in some respects, but essentially these were two guys who were college stars, were destined to be superstars of the Giants, and from the time they were 24, their careers went downhill. I mean, slowly in Hara's case, but they were so similar, guys who weren't really the sharpest tools, you know, in the shed, and lacking apparent, and in Hara's case, didn't know how to manage a game, but he learned. But from the beginning, his whole plan was, we're going to use these guys who aren't stars, you know. And I was thinking, the last thing I ever expected from Hara was to jump outside of his skin and look at the Giants from the outside, saying, we got guys who can play this who weren't like me. So if Takahashi can do that, if he can carry on in Hara's legacy, then yeah, they got a good chance, because the Giants have a load of talent that they've traditionally ignored, and Hara didn't.
Well, I just remember, I know that he showed up to fall camp on the first day in a suit, and I thought, yeah, it's because if he had a uniform on, he would have just gotten out there and got into the calisthenics and started picking up bats and started swinging along with the other players, because forgotten that he was not a player anymore.
I think that was a good move, you know, tell him to show up in a suit, because he might be looking for a fence to crash into.
Hashtag high heat.
All right, well, we've got to crash here and go to sleep, so let's wrap this one up. Thanks a lot for listening, everyone. If you have, and oh, by the way, the Graveyard guys, we are still waiting for a call back from SoftBank, so we will get to your question next week. If anyone else has a question, send an email to ykyujohn@gmail.com. You can tweet us at High Heat at JBW Podcast, or go to our Facebook page and leave us a note there. Thanks a lot for staying up, buddy, with me tonight. So we will talk to you next week. Thanks a lot for listening, and enjoy your international season. That's what we call it. Okay. All right. Let's go with that.
Ciao.
One World Sports is the exclusive home of the Yomiuri Giants in North America and features live coverage of all Giants home games. Please contact your local cable provider to find out how you can watch One World Sports.